Welcome to The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Fred Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the Property Wizard, Fred Crouch.
Welcome back, listeners. My name is Fred Crouch, and welcome to the Property Wizard. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. And we would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Dom Carrillo, and in supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful effort. And thank you for joining us. We've been off the air for a few months for no particular reason, just an awful lot of things happening in our lives. So, Bernie, let's have a quick recap from our previous podcast guest when we discussed evaluating your business with special guest Caroline Troy. You have any thoughts on that, Bernie?
Well, the fact that if you're getting evaluation, either means there's good fortune coming up or you've gone through some misfortune. Good fortune, if you're looking to sell the business, you're going for a bit more cash for the cash flow. Misfortune is if you're going through a divorce or a litigation and or someone's suing you and someone wants to know how much the doggy in the window is worth, actually. So, yeah, fascinating story. And it's also a dynamic number because it doesn't hold true for very long because things change like a ripe wine.
Yep, that's the mystery of appraisals. The appraisal is only good for the day that it was actually conducted. And to all our listeners out there, if you ever had an appraisal done on a property that you own or you're thinking about purchasing, remember that, because the value of your property changes as market conditions change. So, before we carry on and get into the mailbag, just a quick shout out to, it's near the year end, and I just wanted to put out their special mention to our five download centers, because it's kind of fluctuated, and I was kind of like measuring and let our listeners know that we actually hear them and we see where they're downloading the podcasts. So things have changed a bit from last year. Last year, St. Petersburg was alone at top. We had a huge contingent of people in St. Petersburg. But since that time, since last year, they've slipped to fifth place. The fifth place out of 220 odd different cities or centers where this podcast is downloaded isn't all that bad. So just in quick order, the number one place is here in Eastern Ontario, which I'm really quite surprised at, but it is more or less our home base. Coming up second with a lot of steam is Singapore. Singapore, thank you listeners so much for listening and downloading our podcast. It's great to have you listening. Third on the list is Montreal. And fourth is Toronto. Toronto, thank you, Montreal, Toronto. Great to see you joining our podcast. And again, as I mentioned before, St. Petersburg is holding strong at number five. So listeners, thank you again for listening. You've made this podcast and this year an overwhelming success. Thank you. Anything in the mailbag today, Bernie?
You've got me. Well, Fred, yes, we have something from Michael from Espanola, Ontario. He wants to invest in real estate, but doesn't know whether he should focus on residential or commercial investment property. Can you explain to him the pros and cons of both? And he's thanking you, the Property Wizard, because he really enjoys the podcast.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for your question, Michael. That's a pretty loaded one at that, but we're happy to help. We're asked this question by most every new or novice investor. We do get into it a fair bit of detail in our intro course. However, I'm happy to summarize for you. More so than any other factor, it really depends on your comfort level. Are you okay with dealing with your tenants on a 24/7 basis? Not that this is necessarily the standard, but you should be aware that it can happen. Some investors are perfectly fine with dealing with residential tenants on an ongoing basis. Others, well, not so much. Those folks in the not-so-much column may be more comfortable with a commercial tenant, who generally tend to be much more independent and whose hours of business are more in the 9-to-5 arena. In the rare instance where you have a payment issue with a commercial tenant, with few exceptions, the remedy is much more straightforward. If the tenant doesn't pay, the tenant doesn't play, meaning that the landlord, in the vast majority of cases, can simply post notice and lock the delinquent tenant out of the premises. As we're going to find out when we listen to our guest, it's not quite the same when you're dealing with a residential occupancy. Again, in the case of a residential tenancy, it's not so cut and dry. Depending on what jurisdiction you live in, you may have legislation to deal with or very specific guidelines on how you may evict a tenant. I would like to make a rather important point. Do your due diligence on your tenant before handing them the keys or entering into a tenancy agreement, not afterwards. And you'd be surprised how many of our listeners who may have written to us tell us, well, I got into this situation with this tenant. I mean, he checked out, seemed like a really nice person. And then shazam, all of a sudden you're in litigation or it's a nightmare scenario. Of course, there is a way that you can bypass the entire issue of having to deal with tenants, residential or otherwise, and that is by hiring a professional management firm. To that point, again, our guest today, Ian Fortunio, and I say that with an Italian emphasis because it's the only way the words actually come out of my mouth, is an experienced property manager, and he's here today to speak to just that point. There are, of course, other factors that come into play when making a residential-commercial comparison. The amount of money you are prepared to invest is one. The geographical arena or area that you're investing in, the amount of experience you have, both your short-term and long-term investment plans, and finally, local economic factors. Once again, thank you for your question, Michael. We're going to send you an access code courtesy of our sponsor, Gentry Learning, for our online intro to property investing course to help you along your way. Hope you enjoy it. If you have any questions, send your emails to...
They send the information or the request to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. And of course, if there are no problems...
There are no opportunities.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Welcome back, listeners. We're going to keep it light today in the In the News segment. Let's talk about the first item on my hit list and whether you find pickleball courts annoying or whether it's a big part of your fitness regimen. Pickleball courts are coming. They're already here, but they're coming in a big way to the Canadian market. It is estimated that pickleball courts will gobble up about 2.6 million square feet of Canadian real estate space in the next 3 to 5 years. Now, we're all familiar with pickleball, and these courts are not what you think they are. They're not like an outdoor tennis court. These locations are full service and offer courts, coaching, food on site, pro shops, and all sorts of tournaments to participate in. So keep your eyes open for any type of space where it just might be a thing. It might be possible. Now, there are certain requirements. For instance, these courts are generally between 20,000 and 60,000 square feet. And the minimum column space, and this is important because you need the space to fit a court in, is about 18 feet. So paraphrasing from this article, which first appeared in the Real Estate News Exchange, it says, there's going to be a mix of opportunities that we're going to consider as long as they have good exposure. The ideal one is using old retail box spaces. Depending on the market, the sweet spot should be around 40,000 square feet. So anyways, we could do an entire podcast on pickleball courts, love them or hate them. They're here to stay. Apparently the market, they're so popular in the States that the market is pretty much saturated in the US. But here in Canada, apparently it's right for the taking. So that's all we're going to talk about pickleball courts today. The second item that I'd like to talk about, and this is almost becoming an annual thing. We're going to talk about the safest cities in the US. Now, in this particular case, I pulled this article out from Forbes magazine, and they do this every year. They list the safest cities in the U.S. Now, to go on, just to read a little bit about the criteria, this particular article says, what are the safest cities in the U.S.? With more than 430 mass shootings in the United States, almost 14,000 Americans lost to gun violence, nearly 29,000 motor vehicle deaths across the country, and $24 billion in climate disasters, all in 2024 alone, it's no wonder that safety is top of mind for many Americans, whether looking for a place to travel or somewhere to live. To determine the rankings, WalletHub, who actually prepared this list, compared more than 180 U.S. cities and all 50 states across 52 safety metrics. The analysis looked at factors like violent crime rates, road safety, financial stability, vulnerability to natural disasters, and more. Each city and state was graded across three key dimensions: home and community safety, natural disaster risk, and financial safety. Scores were weighted to reflect the relative importance of each factor. So, without getting any more into it, let's reveal what the safest cities in the U.S. are. So, here we go. Number one, safest city in the U.S., South Burlington, Vermont. South Burlington, Vermont. Kind of goes with the territory, wouldn't you think, Bernie? Vermont, you don't really think of it as being, prone to natural disasters. You know, it's just one of those, it's a beautiful state to drive through. I think it's really something else. So that doesn't surprise me so much. South
Farmland.
Casper, Wyoming. Casper, Wyoming is number two. Warwick, Rhode Island is number three. Burlington, Vermont is number four. Boise, Idaho, number five. Yonkers, New York. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Columbia, Maryland. And Portland, Maine. And pulling up number 10 is Virginia Beach, Virginia. So if we carry forward and look at the safest states in the U.S., it's absolutely no surprise that number one is Vermont. Number two, New Hampshire. Maine is number three. Massachusetts, four. Utah, five. Hawaii is number six. Number seven is Connecticut. Number eight, Minnesota. And number nine is Rhode Island. And pulling up number 10 is Wyoming. So that's all we're going to talk about there. So just take your notes, listeners, and be aware. I'd really like to do a comparison over what it was last year, though. I should find that list and just see who's come up and who's gone down. The last item I really want to touch base on is, and this is an article that I found in Wealth magazine, and that's, or the Wealth section of the Canadian Real Estate magazine. And this one talks about dealing with the five myths of buying U.S. residential property as a Canadian. Emphasis on debunked. So this is going to be really, really relevant for a lot of our listeners here. So let's just go through them quickly. Myth number one, you need a U.S. credit history to buy property. The reality of the situation is one of the most common misconceptions is that you need a U.S. credit history to secure financing for a property purchased in the United States. While it's true that many U.S. lenders require a credit history in their country, this is not always the case. Myth number two, getting a U.S. mortgage is difficult. The reality is that beyond worrying about needing a U.S. credit history, many Canadians also worry that getting a mortgage will be complicated and that they'll have to travel to the U.S. just to apply. However, the mortgage process doesn't need to be complex. And here, this article speaks very highly of the RBC, Royal Bank of Canada. In this case, they're suggesting that a potential buyer visit the RBC U.S. Cross-Border Mortgage Services website, and they actually supply a link here. The buying process is similar to Canada. That's a myth. The reality is, while there are some similarities, the process of buying real estate in the U.S. differs significantly from Canada. to the U.S. In several ways, even the time to process mortgages is different. The mortgage processing time in Canada is typically 5 to 10 days, while in the U.S. it takes 40 to 45 days. I want to carry on here just to emphasize a few other changes, too. One of the biggest differences is the role of escrow in U.S. transactions. I mean, people talk escrow, and for many people, they have no idea either what they're talking about or what it means. So when we're talking about escrow, in Canada, the process of buying and selling typically involves lawyers handling the transfer of funds and property. So you go to your lawyer and the funds are deposited in their trust account, and it's up to the lawyer to turn around to disperse funds when the title is actually being exchanged. In the U.S., an escrow agent who is a neutral third party holds the funds during the transaction and ensures that all conditions of the sale are met before releasing the money to the seller. Another difference between Canadian and U.S. transactions are that Canadian closing costs are about 2.5% of the purchase price, often covering land transfer tax and legal fees. U.S. closing costs vary, and banks may charge additional fees, sometimes totaling 1% of the purchase price. Another myth is that foreign buyers face higher property taxes. The reality is that property taxes in the U.S. are based on the property's assessed value and vary from state, county, and even municipality. Contrary to popular belief, foreign buyers, including Canadians, do not automatically face higher property taxes than U.S. citizens. The property tax rate is the same for all property owners, regardless of nationality. Another positive note is that Canada-U.S. tax treaty, or that the Canada-U.S. tax treaty, lets you claim a foreign tax credit on your Canadian tax return for taxes paid in the U.S. And the last myth is that renting out your U.S. property is complicated and risky. Well, the reality is, while renting out a U.S. property does involve certain responsibilities, many Canadian investors successfully rent out their U.S. properties, enjoying a steady income stream, especially in popular tourist destinations. The key to successful property management lies in understanding the local rental market and regulations. For example, short-term vacation rentals may be subject to specific zoning laws or restrictions, particularly in cities like Miami or Los Angeles. Working with a local property management company reduces the burden greatly and ensures all aspects are compliant with legislation. It also provides a great deal of peace of mind. Property managers can handle everything from tenant screening to maintenance and rent collection, reducing the risks and simplifying the rental process. I hope you enjoyed that, listeners, because it's very important, particularly, and it's very relevant to our Canadian listeners. We're asked an awful lot about investing in the U.S., and hopefully we've been able to touch on some of your concerns. Thank you.
Check out the new course offerings at gentrylearning.com. There you'll find answers to all your real estate investment questions. Divided into easy-to-learn interactive segments, it's the affordable way to gain invaluable insight and knowledge into the world of real estate investing. Start the right way. Visit gentrylearning.com.
Ian Fortunio is a real estate broker and office manager at Royal LePage Team Realty and the owner of Praetorian Management Group, a full-service property management firm located in Ottawa, Ontario. He is a recognized authority on residential tenancies in Ontario and has over a decade of experience in property management and real estate transactions. From owning, managing his own properties to overseeing the investment portfolios of landlords and investors, Ian has extensive knowledge of the landlord and tenants, boards, rules, and regulations, as well as expertise in buying and selling properties with tenants in place. Ian is a sought-after speaker. We're really fortunate to have him on the show today. He's appeared on radio, it's pretty difficult to appear on radio, but he's been on radio interviews and podcasts and writes a well-read blog covering a wide range of topics, including small-scale and institutional landlords, tenanted property transactions, and navigating the Residential Tenancies Act. Known for his informal and approachable presentation style, Ian tries to make the complex topic of landlording and property investing accessible, a quality that audiences, as I'm sure our audience, will greatly appreciate. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Great. Well, that's quite an introduction, and in full disclosure, Ian provided me with most of it. So that's pretty high praise, even coming from you. That's tremendous. It's great to have you on the show. Now, listeners, I wanted to make the point that this podcast is going to have particular emphasis or importance to our listeners in the province of Ontario. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't listen to this, because we'll probably hear a few horror stories about how not to do things as well. So if you want to see what's happening in your neighbor's house, stay tuned and keep those ears pert, because I think you'll find what Ian has to say very, very interesting. So let's start off. Ian, what are the key responsibilities for landlords under the Residential Tenancies Act? Well, even before we go there, what is the Residential Tenancies Act?
Yeah, the Residential Tenancies Act is the provincial legislation that governs everything tenancy in the province of Ontario. It really does set forth all the rules and regulations and lets you know the rules of the game that you're going to partake in, which is beneficial both to landlords and to tenants to ensure that they're following those rules.
Makes sense. If there are no rules, you can't break them. So that's exactly why, you know, the Residential Tenancies Act exists. What are the key responsibilities for landlords under the RTA in Ontario? There must be something that the landlord has to do.
I like the way that you set that up, Fred. Yeah, there's definitely something the landlord has to do. And I mean, it's to put it plainly, which is probably the best way, landlords have to act in a reasonable manner within the framework of the law. And that law is set forth in the provincial statute that we've just mentioned, but also local municipal bylaws. So local municipalities can put forth additional items on top of that, and landlords need to make sure that they're aware of what those things are. And the test of reasonability is always discussed, and it is a very broad term, but landlords need to prove that they're trying to follow that. So long story short, they need to provide and maintain a rental unit that meets health and safety standards, both on the provincial level, but also local municipalities. They need to respect tenant privacy with proper notices. They need to adhere to legal processes for rental increases and terminations. And they have to ensure clear communication and documented communication upon the provincial forms that are given to them. Sounds really simple. Maybe not. But if you boil it down to acting as a reasonable person and using the forms that the province gives you, it becomes a little bit more simple.
So just before I pass the microphone over to Bernie, can you give me an example of a rule or guideline that a municipality might impose on a landlord?
Yeah, I mean, we're blessed here in Ottawa, where we like government and we like rules, and our municipal bylaws reflect that. So recently, the Rental Housing and Property Management bylaw was put forward, and that's something that added additional tasks to all landlords in the city of Ottawa. Many of them were already enshrined in the provincial law, but it did add some new and more cumbersome things, you know, such as registries and so forth. And it's something that a lot of landlords, even within the city of Ottawa now, have no clue exists, but they're in contravention by not doing certain things. But usually the easiest one, the most standard one that people go to, are property standards. City of Ottawa defines certain standards that have to be met. And this is one of the ones that landlords struggle with a lot. And the perfect example is, as a landlord, I need a tenant and I may have a unit that is in ill repair. Maybe there's some windows that are cracked. Maybe there's a door that doesn't lock. But the tenant is happy to take that on, and the tenant sees it. They're aware of the issues. They agree in a lease that those issues don't need to be resolved. They're going to get a discounted rent. Instead of, you know, $2,000, they're going to pay $1,500. Everybody's happy. The tenant moves in. The tenant promptly calls the city. The city comes out and investigates, and the landlord is slapped with a work order, because a landlord can't, you know, contract themselves out of the guidelines. And that is unfortunately a real circumstance that happens quite often.
Yeah, and that's so true. Now, what Ian's referencing is that when there's provincial or federal legislation, it doesn't really matter, but we're talking specifically, you know, provincial in this instance. The landlord, it doesn't matter what you and the tenant may or may not agree to when you enter into the tenancy agreement. Now, in the province of Ontario, we have a standard form residential tenancy agreement. You cannot contract yourself out of that. It doesn't matter. Well, you can, but if one or the other party, for instance, if the tenant happens to complain to a city authority or property standards official, and property standards doesn't just knock on your door because they don't have anything better to do. Property standards is response to complaints by the public. You don't even have to be a tenant. They will respond to complaints by the public, not just the tenant. So it doesn't matter that the tenant has seen what damage, and in the example that Ian's given us, it doesn't matter that the tenant is aware of the problem and has agreed to accept the apartment in the condition that it is. As soon as you give them the keys, they can turn around and complain to property standards. And what will happen is exactly what Ian's painted for us. Bernie.
Interesting, Ian, that you'd mentioned that. They come to an agreement in the landlord and tenant, and, you know, all of a sudden it's upside down. It's going sideways, which leads to a dispute. So what are the insights people have to understand about disputes, and how do you manage that effectively as a landlord? Because it's effectively, that's your business, and you're hoping for the best. You're not looking for a dispute. No one goes looking for a fight. Hopefully not. How do you manage that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're 100% correct. I always go back to the fact that I firmly believe that 95% of landlords and 95% of tenants are great people looking to do good things and not have any issues. And there's always 5% on either side that may, you know, from past experiences or whatever is going on, maybe looking to get into arguments. And the best way to try to resolve those is acting in an open and honest way, but you got to set it up for success. And that's set up through really clearly defining the relationship in the lease to begin with. And I mean, the standard form lease right now in the province of Ontario is 14 pages. That's the lease we all need to use. You know, most prudent landlords will expand that. I know when I sign leases for my own personal properties, they're well over 40 pages. And I include the standard form lease and I add a very large addendum. And tenants look at me like I'm crazy sometimes. And in many cases, I am. But when I sit down and explain to them that all I'm doing is further defining what the law has already put forward to ensure a clear understanding so that we don't have an awkward conversation in the future, they think it's a great thing. And we go line by line and we talk about every little thing that has come up in the past in my experiences, and they're able to add things in as well. And that helps reduce the amount of conflict. But when conflict happens, what I always tell our clients to the property management business is look at the entire context. The tenant is a partner in this business. It's not a customer. They are a true partner. They are holding your valuable asset. They're living in it. They're dealing with it on a daily basis. So if it's something that can be easily resolved, resolve it, whether you have to or not as a landlord. And that could be, you know, giving a $50 gift card to a grocery store because a fridge broke and they've lost their groceries in their fridge. Not something that necessarily has to be done, but I think is the right thing to do in many cases. That could be, you know, upgrading a locking mechanism because the tenant is concerned about their safety. Is it absolutely required? Maybe not, but a prudent landlord would do that because not doing that may lead to further issues down the line. And we want to make sure that the tenants feel part of the process. I want them to tell me if, heaven forbid, there's a leak underneath the sink. I don't want them to be shy and say, you know, oh, I don't want to bother you and the landlord. We'll try to figure it out ourselves. We'll put a cup underneath there. No, I want you to tell me so I can bring somebody in to repair it so that there's no damage in the future. You're happy, I'm happy, and all that fun stuff. It's really staying proactive in your communication with tenants. It's defining success up front. And when there is an issue, be open and honest, act in a reasonable manner. And if through that conversation with the tenants, there's still disagreement, at least the tenant understands the why behind the no, which is really, really important in my opinion.
It almost sounds like part of this process requires documentation. I mean, the 40-page addendum would probably speak to that right in the outset, but also tracking the conversations as you go forward. Something's encountered that way, you always have, you know, memory doesn't work well. If paper does, or electronic paper does.
Absolutely. I mean, most property managers, and in fact, most small landlords that don't have property managers are still investing in information retention systems, whether that's a subscription somewhere or whether that's an actual platform somewhere else. They're spending money to be able to house this information. And I know in the city of Ottawa, you're required to hold on to documents of maintenance. And so that's something that a prudent landlord would do, A, because it's now a requirement in the city of Ottawa, but B, it will help you in those conversations. And, you know, you will very quickly forget little things about your property. I assure you, whether it's your one property that you own or 20 properties that you own, you quickly lose sight of those details, and you do need to be on top of the ball.
Yeah. I can share a quick story about that. There was a point in time when I had quite a portfolio of properties under my control. Some I owned, others I managed for other folks. And I can remember having this ongoing, I'm not going to say dispute, but I had a particularly difficult tenant, very difficult tenant. And no matter what it seemed I did, it just didn't want to, like, it just didn't want to turn around and remedy itself. It just didn't. And it got pretty nasty. It got to the point where she was complaining to, you know, the RTA, and, It was just a nasty situation, enough said. So as I'm carrying on the work for the day, I'm walking down a store aisle, and I see this woman, and she comes up to me, and I can't quite figure her out, but in my Eastern European style, I recognize her, but I don't know why. So I go and I give her a big hug and say, how are you doing? How's the season? How's this? How's that? And we carry on. And it's bothering me the rest of that morning as I'm going up and down the aisle, and even after I left the store. Who was that woman? I know her. I just can't put it together. I didn't know who it was until I turned around and I came back, and there was an email from her. And she was the woman who I'd had this ongoing dispute with for the past 2 years. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Add a little bit of honey to the situation. The problem disappeared. So that's a happy ending story. But when you've got a large number of people that you're working with, look, I'll be the first one to admit, my memory's good, but it's short sometimes. But there was no excuse for that in this instance. Anyways, just a little bit of light humor. I want to just go back to a point that you made, Ian. We've heard kind of the opposite too, or maybe it isn't the opposite. You referred to your tenants as partners rather than customers, because we've had other guests on the show, and we've had a rather expansive discussion on that, where it was kind of the point was being made that you should deal with your tenants like they're customers. I mean, treat them with a certain amount of, you know, respect, you know, the old adage, you know, the customer is never wrong, you know, that type of thing. And we were talking about the parameters. Now, your take is a little different. You're suggesting you deal with them as partners. Is there a line that kind of includes both, Ian, in your estimation? Is there room for both? Can you treat a tenant as both a customer and a partner?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
It's a great question. I don't like these because they're so good. Yes, 100%. There's a line that can get blurred and crossed. And the way we've always looked at it at Praetorian Property Management is, you know, our clients, our fiduciary duties are owed to the owners who are, you know, we're signing contracts with, and we clearly define them. And as part of that, the tenants are a large piece of that puzzle. And we call them partners in success to try to help define how we're going to work with them going forward. Because I can't dictate anything to a tenant. The tenant has no contractual obligation to me. I'm simply representing the landlord. And I like tenants to clearly understand that, you know, success to our clients, the landlords, is that at the end of this tenancy, all parties are happy and the property's in as good a condition as possible. That's literally our mission. And tenants need to partner with us to ensure that, A, if there is a problem, that they let us know. Because if we don't know about the problem, it doesn't matter how many times we do proactive inspections. It doesn't matter how many times, you know, our on-site supervisors are there looking around. The tenant is going to know if something's going on before we do, because they hear and see things and they are literally living there. And we want them to feel open to tell us about it. And from there, we then can, you know, fix the problem if it's necessary, fix the problem even if it's not necessary, with the permission of the client. But really walk the tenant along with us as to the why behind it. And in most cases, the tenants in the end really appreciate the fact that they've been involved. Now, don't get me wrong. We have tenants that do not want to be involved. They want no relationship with us at all, other than the fact that they're sending rent to us and that there's a roof over their head. And that's perfectly fine. But we want them to feel as if they are partnering with us to get that asset back to our clients, the landlords at the end, in the best way possible. And in many cases, the route to that is us doing extra things for the tenant with the permission of the client. Hence why I treat them as partners and not clients. But I think it's semantics at that point. You can't always say yes to tenants. You'd be nice if you could, but there are some times where they want a bathroom remodel that just isn't something that the landlord is willing to do and it's not required. I warned you that I ramble in the past. I think I've hit that mark right now, so I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, thank you for that elaboration. That was completely off script, so not an issue from our part. Bernie?
You know, it's interesting. You buy an asset, a property. You have tenants coming in. Hopefully, there are no disputes to sort out. You have the age of the building, et cetera. And then at some point in time, you probably want to divest the asset. In other words, you know, you don't want to be a landlord anymore. You're getting to a certain age, or you're leaving the country, leaving the area, you know, to maybe want to go to St. Petersburg. Who knows, right? Or one of the safe cities in the U.S., or the safer cities, I should say. That all said, how does the RTA influence that whole process? Because when you go to sell a piece of property, and I've been involved in the past with the sale of a commercial asset, or a commercial leased property, and there's a lot of steps attached to it. What does the RTA do in that respect?
Yeah, it complicates things for sure. I mean, when you're trying to divest of an asset, but that asset also is somebody's home, there's an added level of complexity. And the RTA is quite clear that tenants are protected through the Residential Tenancies Act, that if they're in the middle of a termed lease, they are protected. You can't break that lease unilaterally just to sell the property. And if you are selling the property with them in place, and let's say the tenancy has gone to a month-to-month situation, there are still required notices to the tenants, and the notices have to come on the correct forms, and they have to respect timelines. And the one that, through my real estate career, that landlords always get wrong, and many agents out there are confused on the topic, is the notice to a tenant to let them know that the property is being sold doesn't exist. There's no official notice to say, hey, we're trying to sell this property. There is a notice to say the property is sold firm, and we are requiring vacant possession with 60 days notice. And that's because the purchaser has directed us or told us that they're going to move in themselves. And that's a very specific form. That form needs to be filed, and there's an application for a hearing at that point in time. And the thing that everybody gets wrong, and it came very apparent during COVID, is every tenant is entitled to a hearing in the province of Ontario. So just because I filled out the requisite N12 form and I filed it with an L2 notice, and I've gotten my hearing date, a tenant still does not have to leave until that's adjudicated. And so the RTA complicates things. And when I say complicate, that's not a good or a bad thing. But the RTA says that proper forms, proper notices, and that adjudication. And so if those adjudications are taking 6 months, 8 months, 9 months to happen, well, how can I sell that asset and promise vacant possession to a purchaser when I legally can't do so? Well, if I legally can't do so, I can't do it in the contract. And if I can't do it in the contract, I doubt a buyer is going to say, hey, Ian, I'm willing to buy your property. You know, whether that's 3 months, 6 months, 18 months, doesn't really matter to me. Well, they have to line up financing. They need to make sure there's a roof over their head. It gets quite complicated. And landlords really do need to educate themselves as to the reasons you can ask a tenant to leave. And should the tenant not wish to do so, the ramifications of. And we're seeing a lot of litigation on the real estate side of things right now where landlords have promised vacant possession. They sold a property. The tenant has agreed to leave. And then on possession day for the purchaser, the tenant's still there and they're refusing to leave. And there's no hearing even scheduled. And now you're in breach of contract as a seller. And that becomes a bigger issue.
Okay, Ian. So if that's the case, what measures should someone who is selling residential property, who has a unit or a tenant in place like that, what should they do to ensure a smooth transition in relation to the existing tenants? So what can you do as a landlord?
So first and foremost, need to understand the tenant rights. And we've touched a little bit upon that. And really, truly understanding, can I sell this promising vacant possession or can't I? If the tenant is there and they're month to month and they're looking to move out, maybe they've already given you, you know, verbal notice that they're looking for another place and they're going to be out in 15, 20, 30 days. Well, that's where you really need to do your homework and understand, well, that notice needs to come on an N-9 notice and that needs to be clearly documented and, you know, without going down the rabbit hole of tenancy and all the forms and applications, which we could probably talk about for years, Fred, you know, very well. You have to really understand what that looks like. So having a clear conversation with the tenant, letting them know your intentions. You know, I'm thinking of selling the property. Don't worry. We're going to respect the rules and regulations. I've hired a professional real estate agent. I'm going to introduce you in a few moments. They're going to touch base. They're always going to give you notice when they're entering the property. That notice will come with at least 24 hours, so on and so forth. You also need to double down on your knowledge of your own lease. What are the provisions within the lease saying about this? The tenants can grant you permission to give notice via email versus posting. And so you need to look at the lease to see, you know, when that lease agreement was set up, hopefully it was set up in a way that documented all that. And, you know, really coordinating with the tenant is super impactful. I have some great agents that work for me at Royal LePage that understand that this is a very delicate dance. They meet with the tenants. They have a conversation. In many cases, they're buying the tenants, you know, $100 or $200 gift card to their favorite restaurant to say, listen, I know the process sucks. I know you're going to be asked to allow strangers in your home. Don't worry. There's always going to be a professional realtor with them. And, you know, the first couple times this happens, I want you to go out to your favorite restaurant, have a meal, at least, you know, smile and laugh a little bit while, you know, we're in your house and walking through potential buyers. And the other side of the coin is a lot of the times, if you're selling an asset that's tenanted, maybe the purchaser will want it to be tenanted on the other side. So let the tenants know, hey, listen, the more clean this property is, the better it shows, the more amicable you are when, you know, potentially there's potential purchasers walking around in here, the higher the chances are that they're going to want to keep you on as a tenant. So let's partner in this again. Let's make sure we're working towards the same goal because I want you to stay here if possible. And that breeds a lot of conversation, a lot more than we could have on this podcast today.
So would you suggest that that is one of the more common mistakes a landlord makes when it comes to dealing with a tenant in place, not giving them either the opportunity to participate or maybe not giving them adequate notice? Would that kind of be one of the major issues that the landlord can face with the tenant?
Absolutely. And I mean, the really prudent landlord will have a very open conversation with the tenant, let them know what that process looks like. And in many times you can, you know, negotiate something that works for both sides. You know, if Fred was my tenant, I'd say to Fred, listen, I understand this is it's a bit of a silly process. The process is painful. You're going to have strangers walking through your house and they're going to be bothering you with lots of showing requests. So why don't we do something like this? Why don't we say Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sundays are open for showings. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturdays, they're not. I like to eat Cheerios in my underwear on the couch. That way I know Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, there's no chance of anybody barging in on me doing that. And I'm still going to give you the 24 hours notice for those showings on the approved days. And we're going to revisit this after the first week to make sure it's okay. And let's push through that way. Most tenants, after you've had that conversation, the defenses go down and they feel like they're part of that process. And then if you follow up with and don't forget, you know, we can't just kick you out. You're protected under the law in the province of Ontario. Unless somebody buys this, directs us that they want possession for themselves, and you get an N-12 notice from us giving you at minimum 60 days, you're allowed to stay here. There's no issue. But if you don't want to go through all this, and I totally get that, and you would want to be released from this lease in advance, we're open to that. And that's where you delve into a much deeper conversation with the seller about, you know, maybe getting this property vacant before you sell is the better idea. And if that costs you a few thousand dollars, if that costs you, some cases, tens of thousands of dollars, that might actually be putting more money in your pocket, because a really good real estate will be able to sell a property quicker and for more money when it's vacant versus when it's tenanted. And don't forget the costs of getting that tenant to leave, to induce them to leave and make sure it's documented correctly, is tax deductible. And you're going to get to write that off against your capital gains. So in many cases, it's not the exact dollar that you're giving the tenant that you're being charged, if that makes sense.
Well, I'm not going to dispute or suggest that maybe it's more of an operational expense than a capital gain issue. But I mean, it's, you know, it's worth actually exploring for sure. But those are all great points. It seems to me that you're really emphasizing that the best way to manage or prevent any type of tenant dispute is effective communication. Would that be fair to say? Because you're very empathetic when it comes to the tenant's position. I can see how that can be not disarming, but I mean, it kind of takes the tempo down a bit. And I can only see, you know, it being positive. Would you suggest or agree with that?
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct. And your very effective communication just now, summarizing what I've said, is perfect. It is, you know, there are a lot of challenging situations in life, specifically with tenancy. If you're a landlord, you have the ability to rip somebody's security away from them. Like at a base level, you know, housing is a human right. I think we can all agree. And I think we've definitely dealt with tenants that have been challenges in the past. We've worked through them, and there's sometimes you can't come to an amicable agreement with the tenant. Well, that's why the Residential Tenancy Act allows for the landlord-tenant board, which is where you go and you argue and you have a discussion and there's an adjudication made. But if we can avoid that, it benefits everybody because there's costs associated with it, time, lost sleep, you're putting notes together. So if we can act in very humane ways and have open conversations, it benefits everybody. And we're at a time right now where you hear only the very negative from both sides in the media. The reality of it is being a property investor is not without challenge. It's not without risk. There is a reward, but it is a risky business to be in. And so you want to make sure the tenants are working with you, not against you. And being open with that communication, being honest, being unapologetic about the rules, the regs, where you're coming from, it benefits all.
Yeah. A quick question. Keys for cash. Does that work? Because you just mentioned earlier, yeah, you come to an agreement, the broken door, the broken window, yeah, whatever. And then all of a sudden the city comes in and rolls in and goes, yeah, tag, you're it. If you're offering cash for the keys for a certain date, now obviously that's the only reason you're doing that is because it's outside of the process. Can that work? And, you know, or better yet, the other flip side is, yeah, I've seen this in the news. Oh, we're going to renovate the apartments.
Yeah, good, great question. So cash for keys, definitely allowable. There's a form for it. You know, without going into too much detail, the province provides a form for it. And, okay, you know, it basically is an agreement between a landlord and a tenant that says, hey, outside of the scope of the lease, we're okay to end this early. And there are rules attributed to it. Like you can't make a tenant sign. It's an N11 form, but you can't make a tenant sign N11 as a condition to a lease. Hey, I'm going to rent this to you for a term of 12 months, but in advance, you're going to sign this N11 so I can get you out at some point in time earlier, or if I need to sell it. Like that makes that application null and void. So it's a bit more nuanced than that, but yeah, it definitely works. And in some cases, it helps the tenant out. We've seen landlords give, you know, tenants some money that, you know, facilitates the move, allows them to have, you know, a deposit on the other side. And if that works, that works. The other thing you mentioned is the renovation to evict. Renovictions, as people like to call them these days. This is a political, very hot topic right now. I have a very straightforward stance on it, where there's a prescribed set of rules and regulations in place that allow for landlords to maintain their property. And if the property gets to a point where they need vacant possession to do the repair, and they're pulling permits and they're following the rules, such as offering the rental unit back to the tenant after the renovation is done at the same price, it should definitely be allowed. Otherwise, landlords are going to find themselves in properties that are tenanted for long periods of time, but unable to do the repairs that are required for them to follow the, you know, municipal and provincial guidelines. There are some bad actors out there in the past that threaten this to get tenants to leave, and there should be no room for that. But, you know, I'm probably going a little bit too far into my own personal opinion on this, but if you actually look at the numbers, the amount of renoviction applications to the tribunal that are adjudicated and that are actually refused is shrinking, and the amount of those applications are shrinking every year. It's not a rampant problem, or as much of a rampant problem as some are making it out to be, but it's one of those very politicized topics that tenant groups are definitely pointing at, which if landlords are doing it incorrectly, the rules will shake that out. but it's not as big of a problem as we're seeing in the media, in my opinion, or from what I see through, you know, my business practices here in Ottawa.
Thank you for that, Ian. So what initial steps should anyone contemplating a purchase of residential property with tenants in place take to ensure that there are no surprises after the property is purchased?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's two ways to go with that. If you're purchasing the property with the intent of keeping those tenants, you're buying the property, tenants are going to be there. The principle of the dirty diaper sticks. And that principle is you're inheriting the dirty diaper. So you better do a lot of due diligence to ensure that the former owner, the person you're buying the property from, has followed the rules from A to Z. And if they have not, you are potentially inheriting that as the landlord. That dirty diaper follows the property. And so if you're buying that property with tenants in place, you're reviewing leases. You're asking the seller to sign documents speaking to the fact that they've always followed the rules and regs, that there have been no illegal increases to rent, that there are no ongoing issues or applications in front of the landlord-tenant board. And hiring a professional realtor in this manner will help you greatly to navigate that risk. It is a massive, massive risk. And a lot of the files that we are brought into from the property management business to consult on, specifically right now, are people that have bought properties with pre-existing issues, and they're now being dragged through the legal mud on that. Now, on the flip side, if you're buying a property, would you want for it to be vacant, then there are very specific clauses that you need to have in an agreement of purchase and sale. And you need to also be clear that should a tenant overhold, the clauses in the agreement of purchase and sale will give you some weaponry should you want to move forward with a legal action. But a legal action doesn't stop you from not being, the legal action itself won't help you if you're now homeless because that property isn't vacant. If it's a true investment property, you're not buying it to get it vacant for the purposes of you moving in. And so you're not asking the people to serve the N12 notices.
At the end of the day, if you're a new landlord, is there a book like, you know, the Dummy's Guide to RTA? Or, you know, when you're talking, let's say you're looking to buy a piece of property, you know, do you talk to the realtor or do you find a property management firm that goes, yeah, okay, you have a general idea and now let's give you the reality check to how this works?
Yeah, there's a couple different avenues you can go, but unfortunately, there's no landlording for dummies in the province of Ontario. And a lot of the provincial government websites that are set up to give us the rules and regs are not easily deciphered. And so if you're thinking about buying a property, if you're thinking about, you know, becoming a property investor, the best advice possible is yes, definitely speak to a realtor who is well-versed in buying in properties with tenants in place, but also reach out to a property management firm to get some advice. Reach out to a trusted lawyer. There's a lot of research that needs to be done up front. And most professional property managers, agents, lawyers are willing to share a little bit of information and point you in some good directions for you to do a bigger deep dive. And I think the reason that, you know, landlording for dummies in Ontario doesn't exist is it's not a big enough market. I know there's some books out there that profess to speak to landlording in all of Canada, but each province has very specific rules and regs. And it's the reason that I, as a property manager, would never give advice to anybody that isn't speaking specifically to, you know, an Ontario postal code, because they are so dramatically different across the entire country.
Absolutely, for sure. So we have a couple more questions for you, but I'm going to group them together because I want to hear your rant, because I've heard your rants and they can be very, very interesting. So what I'd like you to do is answer the following. First of all, how do you see the RTA evolving in the future? You know, especially in response, or it may not even have any effect, but especially as a response to the current housing market that we find ourselves in. And do you think that the Landlord and Tenant Board, LTB processes, could be improved to better serve both landlords and tenants? So take it away, Ian.
So I think this is something that is going to become more and more politicized. We've already seen this happen. It will ramp up. There is a crisis. There's a housing crisis. As a realtor and as a property manager, I've never been more popular and more hated at the same time. Housing is on the tip of everybody's tongue. And when that happens, politicians like to jump in. And I'm a political nerd. It's one of the reasons I live in Ottawa. I absolutely love politics. I think politicians now see this as the crisis that it is, but they also have to play the political game. And so fingers get pointed, people get blamed, and then we start sorting through the rest. And we've seen a lot of very knee-jerk reaction type policies come forward that have actually punished small landlords. And small landlords, I'm going to do a rant here, Frank. This is Fred. This is awesome. Small landlords are the lifeblood of tenancy. In Ottawa, it's more than 50% of the supply is given by small landlords. These are the landlords that provide the good rental stock that families can live in, that you can, you know, put down roots and live somewhere for multiple years. They're following the rules, but they're the easiest ones to pick on right now. And so we've seen a proliferation of rules and regulations that make it much tougher against them, which means they generally sell off those properties. And when they sell off those properties, it doesn't put a dent in the resale market. It just shrinks the rental market, and that actually increases rents. So we need to be a little bit more friendly with small landlords, in my opinion. I had to work that in there somehow, Brett. And so what's going to happen going forward is government, all levels of government are going to see this as an issue. They're going to put forward some policies, and then we're going to get down to the brass tacks. And what needs to happen is really good, well-hearted landlords, well-hearted tenants need to sit somewhere and have a discussion. And that's what I'm most looking forward to in the next couple of years, hopefully, is some sort of permanent secretariat or round table that brings together different levels of government, tenants, landlords, and have a true discussion as how this can be resolved. And the lowest hanging fruit, I feel, is working with the Landlord Tenant Board in the province of Ontario, is reopening the offices. Right now, the Landlord Tenant Board offices are closed. Everything is done virtually and has slowed down the process dramatically. And what needs to happen is those doors need to be reopened, because I saw it when I was going and representing clients there in the past. 30 to 40% of the files get resolved in the hallway. I'm sitting across from Fred. I'm sitting across from Ian. I'm working with George, whatever it is. And these are my tenants. And I look them in the blues of their eyes and I say, listen, I don't know how we got here. How did it get so bad? I understand that you had an issue with the washer. I tried to fix it. It didn't work. That doesn't mean you can't stop paying me rent. And now we're 3 months behind. So why don't we do this? I'm going to get you on a payment plan. You're going to agree to pay me back. We're going to make sure the washer dryer is working. And that then gets put on a piece of paper. It's stamped. And that is an actual order. So we don't need to come back to the tribunal. If anybody breaks that deal, we can go straight to a sheriff and get an eviction. And what that did is that shrank the amount of files by 30 or 40%. It was done in minutes. You didn't have to wait the full day to go through the trial process. And it enabled the adjudicators to work through the mass number of files that were on their tables.
Because they primarily didn't see all of them because they were...
Exactly. It was done before. Right. And you've seen it too, Fred. Like when you show up to the tribunal, you don't know when the case is getting heard. So you could be sitting there for 8 hours. And in many cases, if you're fifth or sixth on the docket, you're sitting there for 8 hours. And at the end of the day, they haven't heard you. And you got to come back another day. And that's another 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. And so if that can get taken care of through mediation in the first 15, 20 minutes of the day, that benefits everybody. And the tenants and the landlords, when they look at each other and they go, oh my God, I can't believe I was so stubborn. I apologize. How did we get here? Let's figure this out. It's a win for everybody. And going forward, that's super beneficial because now everybody understands that we're kind of on the same page here. And the Landlord Tenant Board has gone through some changes. Probably in the last 10 years, they did lose a lot of adjudicators. And these adjudicators, if the adjudicators are focusing more on the paperwork than the actual overall file, that's where it slows things down. And we've seen a ton of that in the province of Ontario. And I've been really excited recently where I've been, you know, monitoring some of the, you know, online adjudications, and everybody's allowed to join and view these, where adjudicators have said, listen, Madam Tenant, I understand that the landlord put a check mark where they actually should have put an X. And that is technically incorrect according to the rules and regs. But I think you understood what the landlord meant in their application. And I'm not willing to throw this file out based on that. That is a new thing. That has not happened in 10 years. I can tell you, I've been involved in files where a self-represented landlord put a check mark where they should have put an X, and they had to wait 8 months to get a re-adjudication on the file.
Unbelievable.
And we're now seeing a maturity level with the adjudicators where they're now putting reasonability back in the test, which is only going to help. So all that to say, they need to reopen the tribunal, need to get people looking at each other in the eyes again and having like true conversations and connecting, and just continue educating the adjudicators and ensuring the adjudicators are focusing more on the reasonability of a file versus the minute details as to who ticked what and where. And I think that will resolve the vast majority of the 60,000 files that are still sitting on the docket to be resolved.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. You bring up some incredibly important points. You really do. And I can share from my own experience how, and not even sitting in front of the board, but being part of focus groups dealing with relationships between landlords and tenants and redevelopment of properties where tenants can be temporarily displaced. I've sat on some of these committees, and believe you me, it is really, really slanted against the landlord, in my opinion.
Yep. Yep.
They really can be. So to hear that there's a certain level of maturity that now exists is music to my ears.
It definitely goes back to something I said earlier on, where I think investing in real estate is, there's huge risks involved, right? And most small scale investors, they are generally out of pocket month to month.
And with pump operations, you're right.
Yeah. And these are the landlords that we want to be involved, because they're not going to, you know, they're not going to tie things up in with lawyers and court cases and hedging their bets as to if I try to push the line here, what's it good? No, they're trying to follow the rules, and they're willing to go out of pocket month to month for an appreciating asset, right? This property is going to go up in value on a long enough horizon, and, you know, principal recapture, the mortgage is getting paid and so on and so forth. So I'm willing to be out of pocket a couple hundred bucks a month so that in 10, 15, 20 years, I actually now have an investment that's made me some good money, and maybe that's my retirement. Perfect. But when you take away the rules of the game, because the promise to lure in these investors from the province is that things will get adjudicated in 2 to 3 months. And I'm holding on to a last month rental deposit, so that, you know, that helps me out a little bit. So if it takes 2 months to adjudicate, what's the potential damage to me? Maybe I lose a month, maybe I lose 2 months, whatever it is. But we were seeing adjudications taking 12 to 16 months during COVID. And people don't talk about the fact that once it's adjudicated, and let's say that you win, well, to get mailed that decision was taking another 2 to 4 months. So that's just winning the case. That doesn't mean I've gotten any money. So can I take on 16 to 20 months of not being paid rent? No, that will break my back financially. I will have to most likely sell my principal residence at that point, or refinance that. And so I will leave as a small scale investor, and I'll dump my money into a larger scale REIT who will invest in large swaths of real estate, and I'll get a 3 to 4% return at a minimum, and I'll make my money that way. Or let the rules stand. We know what the rules are. At worst, I'll be out 2 to 3 months. Fine, I'll take that risk, which will encourage more small scale landlords. And a small scale landlord buying a property, fixing it up, or renting it is one of the biggest injections in a local economy. I will do that every day, as long as I know that the rules are being enforced or in place. And that's why it's so critical that the landlord tenant board really do put their arms back around. And we've seen some really good work in the last 6 months. I was at Queen's Park. I was sharing with you earlier, Fred, a couple of weeks ago when we were doing some lobbying on behalf of the Ontario Real Estate Association. And I happened to take the opportunity to talk landlord tenant board stuff, because that's what I always do. And very happy to see that, you know, generally speaking, your files are now going to take about 4 to 6 months to hear, and you're generally getting decisions within a month. 7 months is still a really long time, but it's coming down. So let's keep pressuring our politicians and ensuring that that landlord tenant board is working through that backlog of files, because a lot more smaller scale landlords is a good thing for everybody. And I'm not saying larger scale landlords are bad, but I am saying that smaller scale landlords are much more apt to pick up the phone when you're calling because there's an issue, and they're going to drop off a nice bottle of wine at Christmas time to thank you for being a good tenant. And they're going to do the nice things that make us feel all part of that community. And that sounds very hokey, but it is very true.
No, I want to be one of your tenants. Boy, I get gift certificates for dinner. I get wine if I call up to complain. I don't know about you, Bernie, but I'm thinking about selling the whole boatload and becoming one of Ian's tenants. Have anything else, Bernie, you care to ask our esteemed guest?
Well, Ian, process has been fascinating, and I really appreciate your approach on how you engage client in the equation, right? Because it's, you know, your business, a client, but it's not a mechanical relationship. It's more, you know, a person to person, and it is their house. I find that interesting. Are there any other types of agreements that are out there for housing that landlords can take a peek at. It might not fit in this context right now, or it might not fit within this podcast. But are there other types of agreements where you can have a relationship with and not be Airbnb?
Yeah. So what we're speaking about today, and what I kind of hang my hat on is, residential tenancy, traditional residential tenancy, which is anything a month longer. There are other businesses out there such as short-term rentals, but also rooming homes, vacation setups. That's not where I do my business, but they are heavily legislated and there are a multitude of other agreements that, investors need to look into on that. And that's, those are more generally covered by contract law than the Residential Tenancies Act. Residential Tenancies Act, traditional tenancy, anything longer than a month.
Well, Ian, I want to thank you very much for sitting in the hot seat. I think many of our guests, those particularly in the province of Ontario, are going to find this podcast very, very informative. I understand that we can't necessarily get into all the nuances, and hopefully I've been able to balance the rants with the actual content. So, but you did a great job, Ian. Thank you so very much for being our guest today. Now, before we let you go, we have a few rapid fire Q&As.
Ian, what are you reading right now? What's your favorite book that's caught your eye and you're getting into?
I'm actually rereading a book called Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. And the reason I'm rereading it is he's come out with another book called Nexus that I really want to dig into. But it talks a little bit about human history, and there's a lot of low-key, subtle, sarcastic humor involved, which I'm all about, but gives a kind of a big picture perspective of human history and kind of lets us know what's going on modern society style, which is, I find, very interesting.
Did you read his book, Homo Diaz?
No, I have not. I think that was his second book.
Yeah, I've read that one too. It's very much along the same lines. I find him very, you're right. It's kind of I don't like him in an in-person one-on-one interview. I don't find he's a really, personally, I don't find he's a really engaging type personality to have on a one-on-one. I think I saw him on Bill Maher not that long ago. I think earlier, maybe during the summer months. But his books are really, really interesting. Really interesting. His latest book, the one you're speaking about, is on my letter to Santa. So we'll see where that winds up. So what's your favorite book?
It's a little darker, but it's The Fourth Turning by William Strauss and Neil Howe. It talks about reoccurring generational cycles, and it breaks them out into sort of 80 to 100 year blocks. And it traces back human history and speaks to four turnings. So there's the high, which is that first portion. Everybody's really excited. It's usually after a major crisis, but we as a society have come together and done good things, and we're super excited. There's the awakening, which is that period of, you know, we've gone through the boom and we're still in the boom a little bit, but now we're starting to question things, and we're thinking maybe things are going somewhat sideways. There's the unraveling, which is where people stop believing in institutions. People start thinking more of an individualistic side of things, you know, that mindset of scarcity, which may be ringing a bell right now. And then there's the crisis, which is where there's a major upheaval, usually involves wars or societal disobedience. And it's scary in many ways. I love the book, and I've gone back to it a couple times and reread certain portions. But it is lined a little bit with, I find, a positive sort of red ribbon in it that pulls you through. That's like, listen, this isn't the first time we've been through this sort of thing, and we'll come through the other end and things will get better. And overall, we're at a really good time in history, right? We're blessed. We can, you know, we're talking about tenancy and real estate. This is cool stuff. These are things that we're passionate about, and we can make a living doing this. That's awesome. Because it wasn't too long ago where we would be forced to wake up and all we could do is the things that we needed to do to live that day, you know, grow crops, fetch water, thatch the roof, and that's about it. So yeah, The Fourth Turning's a great book. For any of the listeners, if you haven't read it, I highly suggest it, but you have to have the right mindset, I think. You have to have a little sense of positivity while you're reading it. Otherwise you can get pulled into the abyss for sure.
Yeah, I can see the parallels between that and Sapiens. Quite frankly, listening to you talk, I haven't read the book that you're referencing, but it's, you know, it's interesting. Bernie, let's go to your favorite topic.
What are you implying, Fred? Did I have a bit of a weight loss issue to deal with? So, you know, Ian, what is your favorite dish? And what you know, like, if, you know, if someone's going to offer it, what would make you salivate and go, yeah, that's the ticket?
I got to give you two answers. Chicken Parmesan and smoked meat. Not together, because that would be weird. But chicken Parmesan is by far one of the greatest things ever invented, whether it's in the sandwich form or the more traditional form with some pasta. And then on the right day, smoked meat will solve all the world's issues, in my not so humble opinion. So,
boy, you're speaking my tune. So what's your, as far as an accompaniment is concerned to that exquisite meal, I think you could put sliced smoked meat over chicken Parmesan, you know, maybe make, you could probably do that at, anyways, topic for another day, other podcast. So what's your favorite alcoholic beverage?
I love Guinness. I'm a big Guinness guy, and it's gotten a lot more popular over the years, but I have loved it for quite some time. I don't make enough money to be a really big fan of scotch yet, because I was warned by a professor way back when, do not develop a taste for it until you can afford it. I've started to develop a taste for it, and I cannot afford it. So I'll go back to the Guinness for now.
There we go.
You get a dozen of those bottles that have like a triple dollar price, you know, three digits in there. I was in the liquor store the other day, and I'm like, oh my gosh, who buys that? And I know who would, but yeah. So while you're in the liquor store, how do you describe a perfect day? You know, it's not necessarily in the liquor store, but what is your perfect
day? In the liquor store.
Yeah, that's a tough question. Not just the liquor store aspect of it. I'm an early riser. I'm a nerd. I've never needed an alarm. So I will wake up stupidly early. And what I love doing on the weekends is I wake up really early, have a shower, have a coffee, and then I go for a walk. And if you could see me, you wouldn't say I'm an avid walker, but I assure you I am. And I'm a political nerd. I live downtown. I'm blessed. I get to walk around Parliament Hill every single day. And I go behind there and I look at the statues and I look across the river, and it's wonderful. And that's the first hour of every weekend, Saturday and Sunday. I usually would then, you know, come back to the house, and then my wife is woken up, and then we'll probably go out to sort of a Greasy Spoon diner and have a nice breakfast. Who doesn't love that? That's awesome. This is going to sound really hokey, but I probably after that go back to the house and do a little bit of real estate tenancy related work. I truly love it. I am very passionate about it. I love every aspect about it. Probably have a nap after that, because who doesn't like a good nap? Sort of like mid-afternoon.
It's a weekend. Yeah.
So, you know, and you're
drinking that before. So.
And then after that, my wife's family is Greek, and they live very close to us, and I have a great affinity for them. So I probably do dinner with them. They cook and do wonderful things for me. They cook the greatest meal, and then watch a Bruins game. I'm a big Bruins fan. Maybe a Red Blacks game if it's football season, and then bed pretty early because I'm an old man. That's a perfect day for me. That sounds really good, actually. Other than doing a podcast with you guys, of course.
You're too kind. So where's your favorite place to visit in the world? And of every place that you've been to, where's the favorite place you like going to?
My wife will never let me forget this, but I fought tooth and nail with her. When we got married, I didn't like traveling. I didn't want to go anywhere. And then she took me to Greece one time. And we try to go back every year, if not every other year since.
Wow, really?
Greece is wonderful. And there's so many different areas in Greece. And there's so many different islands if you want to go island hopping. And we're very blessed because Gina has family all over Greece. And so we kind of tour around and we're treated like royalty. And then we find an island or two to kind of finish our trip off with just ourselves. And Greece is just wonderful. People are wonderful. Food is excellent. People understand what life really is about there. And yeah, Greece for sure. That's the one question I'm very confident my answer today. And I even was able to ramble about it. Greece, there you
go. There you go. Bernie, take us home.
On a hot summer's day, it almost sounds like a meatloaf song. On a hot summer's day, what do you enjoy for a good ice cream?
Oh, boy. Okay. So I got two answers for you. Classic vanilla ice cream probably is nature's perfect food. I think it's the greatest thing ever. It has to be like a good classic. None of this fancy stuff. Just classic vanilla.
Oh, a scoot or soft serve?
Scoot. Soft serve is a cheater's way. It's not really ice cream at that point. Let me tell you. It's ice milk. They just beat air in the milk. That's cheating. Fred, you got to be a purist when it comes to these things. Or if I'm feeling fancy, which happens rarely, and it's not really ice cream, it's gelato, but a pistachio gelato affogato is the greatest thing. A little bit of espresso on top of pistachio gelato and you eat it.
Oh, I like that. Oh, that's a nice note.
Was 110 when I discovered that, and I'm now well above that, I assure you.
Okay. Ian, again, thank you so much for being our guest today. It was an absolute pleasure. It was informative. Everything I heard about you is definitely proven right here in front of our audience. So if any of our audience listeners have any questions or find themselves in a little bit of a pickle, how can they get a hold of you, Ian? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
The best way would be emailing me at theunapologeticlandlord@gmail.com.
Wonderful. Unapologeticlandlord@gmail.com. So you've heard it here, listeners. Feel free to reach out. Again, Ian's got a whole lot more in his repertoire. We could have kept him going all day. And I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back as a return guest. If you'll have us, Ian, if you'll have us.
Of course, it's been a blast. Thank you very much to you both.
Great. Glad you enjoyed it.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
Listeners, today, our word of the day is, actually words of the day, is our estoppel certificate. So here's the definition. It's explained by our friends at Wikipedia. What is an estoppel certificate? An estoppel certificate is a document commonly used in due diligence in real estate and mortgage activities. Now, Ian, can you tell me when you would use an estoppel certificate when, let's say, you're buying or selling a residential property?
I could tell you many, many times, and I'm going to relate it back to tenancy because that's what I do. We have people buying properties and they're not truly understanding the rules and regs. And I know the estoppel certificate would definitely contain some of these rules and regs specifically related to tenants.
Essentially, an estoppel certificate is based on the principle of estoppel, the legal principle that prevents or estops someone from claiming a change in the agreement later on. It's used in a variety of countries for commercial and residential transactions. So in a residential situation, what will end up happening is that the buyer, in a number of instances, would ask to view the estoppel certificates from the tenants. So what happens is that the landlord, the current owner, will go to each and every tenant in the building and ask them to sign what's called an estoppel certificate. Now, this certificate outlines what they're paying in rent, whether there was a last month's rent deposit given, what utilities are paid for by either the landlord or the tenant, and other things like parking privileges and who pays for certain utilities and all the rest of it. So that's what an estoppel certificate is. So a landlord would gather those together. Any individual buying that property is going to want to ask to view them. So then they're going to take a look at that and they're going to compare the estoppel certificates with what the advertised rent roll is. And if there's any discrepancies, the time to address those is before you actually take over and buy the property. So remember that, estoppel certificates. So again, Ian, thank you for being our guest today. We know how to get a hold of you. So that's brilliant. And I most certainly hope that you come back and join us. So listeners, join us next podcast when we'll be discussing Real Estate Fraud, Volume 1. Anything you care to add, Bernie?
Well, Fred, I've really enjoyed Ian's conversation and perspective on how to deal with the people you're engaging with from landlord-tenant relationship. Very smart move. I can truly say that resonates from my past experiences is the best way. It's collaborative. And it just saves you from, you know, otherwise you end up sitting across from each other at a tribunal going, how did we get here? Like, what happened, right? Almost like you need marriage counseling.
I don't think that's too far from the truth. Again, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And remember,
if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities. Thanks. Have a great week, everyone.
And if you have any questions, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
Thank you. Enjoy the holidays.
Thanks for listening to Fred and Bernie on another edition of The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. Got a question? Ready to invest?
email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentrylearning.com. Remember to like and leave us a comment and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode of The Property Wizard.